Today at Reader's Corner, Stephen Talty, author of Agent Garbo, the brilliant, eccentric secret agent who tricked Hitler and saved D-Day. I'm Bob Kustra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Few would put the name Juan Pujol alongside Eisenhower, Churchill, and Roosevelt, the Allied giants of World War II. Yet this underachieving chicken farmer from Barcelona could very well be the pivotal figure in one of the 20th century's most important events, the Allied landings in Normandy during the summer of 1944. In his book, Agent Garbo, the brilliant, eccentric secret agent who tricked Hitler and saved D-Day, Stephen Talty details Pujol's cloak-and-dagger deeds as an extraordinary spy in the titanic struggle against Nazism. Employing charm and an amazing talent for deception, Pujol became Germany's most valuable secret agent, when in reality he was a double agent working with the Allies. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Stephen Talty. He is a widely published journalist and the author or co-author of a number of other books, including A Captain's Promise, which was the basis for the movie Captain Phillips, starring Tom Hanks. Mr. Talty joins us by phone for this interview. Stephen Talty, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Well, let's start with this massive disinformation campaign surrounding the Normandy landings in June 1944. I will just point out to our listeners who may not have a map of England and France in front of them, as I do, that if you take a look at Dover, England, and Calais, France, it's a 30-mile journey from one country to the other. But if you go considerably west, at least 100 miles down the coast to the site of the Normandy invasions, it's a much greater distance up to England and where these folks would have to come across. So it would make good sense if the Germans are trying to figure out where we're going to come from, that we'd come from Dover and head right into Calais, which, as I said, is a 30-mile journey. So tell us how Juan Pujol, or better known as Agent Garbo, what did he do to pull this off?
Well, you're right. Calais was the obvious landing point, and many in the Nazi high command believed that it was the only way to go, and that it was definitely going to be the site of the D-Day landings. So actually, many in the Allies and in the command there didn't believe D-Day could be disguised. They believed Pujol's mission was fool's gold, that there was no way to disguise so many men, so many ships, so many planes, and the thing to do was just sort of perhaps try and disguise the date that it was coming, to try and spread misinformation and say that perhaps it's coming in late summer, because the operation was simply too big. It was really the largest invasion in human history. How are you going to disguise that? But Pujol had gained Hitler's and the high command's confidence. He was their mole inside of London, and he had done this through a series of messages and operations where he seemed to have knowledge of big operations, invasions, North Africa, the landings at Casablanca before they happened. Casablanca is one sort of important thing in building up his reputation. He actually sent a letter saying that this is where the invasion is going to hit. All the facts were accurate. But of course, he and the Allies arranged for that letter to arrive 2 days after the invasion commenced. So he was solid gold in the eyes of Hitler and the other generals. So what they did was have Pujol create this network of agents, 26 agents in all, spread all over England. They were all imaginary. They all came from the mind of Juan Pujol. And he would send back reports from these guys saying, this division has just moved into Portsmouth, or this one has just been seen at Dover, or I found this sergeant drinking in a tavern, telling secrets in this little town. So he slowly built a picture of an invading army poised to strike at Calais. And what the Allies did is that behind this lone spy, who was really assisted by really only three or four other double agents, they built a whole kind of theatrical production. They had fake airfields in the wrong parts of England. These airfields were so convincing that English pilots would sometimes see them and come in for landing and realize at the last moment that it was a farm and not a real airfield and crash land.
That's amazing.
They built fake destroyers. They had fake encampments that looked like 100,000 men were staying there when it was really maintained by a crew of perhaps 250 guys who were lighting the fires at night. And so they really created kind of a Hollywood spectacle, but Pujol was the guy writing the screenplay. He was the one selling the storyline. And all these other factors, all these other tidbits that were really coming from around the world. They would have guys walk into bookshops in the Middle East and ask for the Michelin map for a certain part of France. That part of France was Calais. And they would sort of act suspiciously and get outraged when that map wasn't available. So people began to realize that all this attention was being focused on Calais. So it was, you know, an elaborate deception that Pujol was really the point of the spear of.
Where was Pujol actually living and working during this entire Operation Fortitude?
He was in London. He was a Spaniard. He'd been brought over from Madrid, brought with his wife. So he was really commuting. He was sort of like an office worker. He would go on the subway every day, show up at the office. He had a handler from MI5, Tommy Harris, who was sort of his match in brilliance and creativity. They would sit in an office, very nondescript, and just spin up these fantasies and start thinking of ways to sort of, you know, attract the German mind. They both knew the Germans very well, and they both thought up these schemes back and forth. You know, they were totally unprotected. No, they had no guards. Nobody knew who they were. So they were, like, vitally important, just as important in certain ways as, you know, top commanders in the Allied force. But they were just sitting in a drab office in London telling stories to each other, and those stories became sort of fake military plans that were passed to the Nazis.
I thought one of the most fascinating things I learned is not just that he pulled this off, but then he was awarded the Iron Cross, which I assume is like, what, the highest medal the Germans could give out for valor or contribution to the cause?
Right. I mean, the Iron Cross was really only given for on-the-field valor, for, you know, bravery in battle. But the Abwehr, which was one of the German intelligence services, was so impressed by Pujol's work. They thought that, you know, he was sort of their sort of their linchpin within the British system, that anything the British were going to create was going to be transmitted to Pujol, and he was going to be able to tell them the war plans. So they arranged to have this Iron Cross sent across to Pujol, and at the same time he was being given the OBE by the King of England, Queen of England, I should say. And so he was one of the few people in history really to get these really high commendations from both sides. So yeah, he was sort of so masterful at what he did that even after the war, the Germans were making up excuses. They couldn't conceive of the fact that he was a double agent. Many of them went to their grave swearing that Pujol was true blue to the Nazi cause and that something else must have caused the confusion about Normandy.
So obviously after the war, it's not like Pujol comes out of the closet and says, aha, I'm the guy interviewed by all the papers. I mean, your book, of course, goes on to tell that this is a guy who basically goes into hiding for the rest of his life. But that's another story we'll get to in a moment. But the timing of these awards, in other words, did they come after he did this? Did they come after the invasion?
Yes, they did. They came in 1945 and just after, really when the war was ending.
Yeah, these Germans were still relatively clueless about this guy's role because obviously they didn't. No one made it out to be a big deal.
Right, and Pujol had such confidence in himself and such sort of mastery over the Germans that he actually went back to Spain where his German handlers were living, and he went to investigate sort of one of the last worries of the Allied high command was that a Fourth Reich was going to be organized and that the survivors of the German intelligence service were going to go underground or go to South America, as many of them did, and sort of foment another sort of Nazi revolution. So he was sent back to meet with these guys who had been handling him from the German side for years and sort of interrogate them about what their plans were. I mean, is their Fourth Reich going to come? So he was basically marching right back into enemy territory. Spain at the time was really kind of a German colony. I mean, it was fascist. It was very much under their control. So he sort of walked into the lion's den where he could have been, you know, executed on sight had they known. And he went back to these guys and said, you know, what are your plans? What's happening next? What is the Nazi high command going to do? And they just worshipped him. They thought he was like a gift from God. They couldn't believe he sort of made it out of England alive. Of course, you know, he had MI5's help in that. So really, right up until the last moment, they were entranced by this fiction that he created.
My guest today is Stephen Talty. He's the author of Agent Garbo, the brilliant, eccentric secret agent who tricked Hitler and saved D-Day. You know, if you'd read just this part of the story that you've told to this point in the story, you come away with the impression, well, boy, this guy must have been a patriot, and he must have been like England's or Spain's number one macho man. But as I read your book and read between the lines, this is a very complicated character. He wasn't as much into ideology, it appears, as he was into just the idea that if I can save lives, no matter whose lives they are, then there must be a role for me to play.
Right. You have to remember that Pujol had been through the Spanish Civil War, which was in many ways sort of a dry run for World War II. You had, you know, extreme left ideology versus the fascists. So he'd seen both sides up close, and he'd been unimpressed by both. He'd sort of gone through the war as a conscientious objector. He didn't want to kill anyone because he just was repulsed by both ideologies. But when he saw Hitler arising in Germany, he thought, at last, this is a cause that I can be against. This was very black and white for him. He saw Hitlerism as just a total desecration of humanity. But he wasn't, you know, ideological in the typical sense of a true blue patriot, as you would say. He just felt that he wanted to stop Hitler as soon as possible and save as many lives, really both German and American and English, as he could. So he made this decision in Madrid to sort of offer himself to the British Secret Service. And the ironic thing is that he walked into the British Embassy in Madrid four different times, and they both basically told him to get lost. I mean, he had no credentials. He had no training. He was a chicken farmer, as he said. And he basically failed in everything he'd set out to do. So he was a complete disappointment, kind of a Walter Mitty figure, very much of a dreamer. But he had this incredible imagination and this ability, when he was face-to-face with people, to sort of get them to believe what he was saying. I mean, I say in the book that had he been a less moral person, he would have been, you know, the original Ponzi, like the original Bernie Madoff. He was just incredible in getting people to believe these fantasies that he was spinning. So it took him four efforts with the British to finally get accepted. And to get accepted, he actually had to go to the Germans and volunteer to be a spy for them so that he could sort of get material and get information that he could then offer to the British. So it was a really sort of daring, life-risking operation that he went through just to get into the British Secret Service.
It does seem like that is a moment where you have to say, this guy's going to unbelievable ends to play a very personal role in this war, and one where he's risking his own neck.
One thing I found when I was writing the book was that there were really hundreds and thousands of people who were desperate to get out of Spain, desperate to get out of Portugal, where Pujol operated from as well. But very few of those were accepted by either side because they felt that very few of them could offer anything to the Allies or to the Axis powers. So Pujol sort of cut through that whole curtain of people trying to get out, and he was just convincing in person in ways that other people weren't. He had this God-given talent, and it had sort of met its moment in history. I mean, he'd found a way to play sort of a world historical role. So as we'll perhaps go into later, he killed himself off. He basically put out a story through MI5 that he died in Africa. So he could take no credit for this incredible, you know, coup that he pulled off. He couldn't tell people, and he couldn't sort of leverage it into, you know, a new career, a new life. So he had to sort of start from scratch again.
When he was trying to convince the German spy service that he was going to help them out, what was he, stationed in Lisbon or something? But he was, one of his first efforts to fool people, I guess, was to convince the Germans that he was spying from London?
Right. He was dealing with the Abwehr, the German intelligence service in Madrid, and he said, send me to Portugal. Because Portugal had flights to the free world. It had flights from Lisbon to London. It was one of the few places still open to the free world. So he said, send me to Lisbon and let me show you what I can do. So he went to Lisbon, and he sent reports back saying that he'd made it to London. So he used this elaborate scheme to sort of fool them to believe the letters were coming from London, where he was stuck in Lisbon with everyone else. And what he would do is literally sort of walk the streets and visualize what he could sell the Germans. So he'd see sort of a war poster in, you know, a shop window, and he'd memorize the details of the ship shown on there. Perhaps it was a British ship. And he'd send back a letter saying, you know, this new destroyer has so many guns, et cetera. My sources are saying, you know, it's sailing out of Liverpool or whatever. So he would start with something concrete, something real. And he would just fantasize about it in such a way that was accurate. I mean, he really had the makings of a great kind of spy novelist, because he could convincingly draw and imagine things that fooled even people who were experts. So he would look at leaflets that were dropped out of British planes, pick up any clue he could, and just make things up. Of course, this couldn't go on forever. And eventually, when MI5 got a hold of him, they were just astonished that he'd lived so long, because people had tried this before and they'd ended up in concentration camps. But something about Pujol, he just had the knack of not going too far, being convincing, and basing everything into the tiny speck of reality.
You mentioned the name before. Was Tommy Harris, the MI5 guy, was he the guy that actually is responsible for, you might say, finding Pujol?
No, Tommy Harris was the guy who eventually, what they call, ran him. He was the MI5 handler. But how MI5 came across Pujol is that they intercepted one of his messages back to the Germans, where he predicted that there was a convoy headed to the island of Malta. And the Germans believed this. They scrambled planes and they sent warships out to stop this convoy that was heading. And the convoy was completely imaginary. I mean, Pujol had just made it up out of the thin blue air. But when the British saw this and they saw the German reaction, they said, my God, here's an agent who has Germans' confidence. We have to get hold of him, because establishing an agent with the Germans was very difficult. You know, to get their confidence was a tough thing. So this guy was sort of vetted already. He was already, you know, in the pocket of the Germans. So they tried to find where these messages were coming from, and it led them to Juan Pujol, who all along had wanted to work for the British, but was sort of discovered through an accident of a message being intercepted.
So a guy like this, in the middle of this war effort, is hardly going to be able to go home and find the Ozzie and Harriet lifestyle from the 1950s TV series. And that's the sad part of this in some ways, is that his personal family life, the role of his children or lack thereof. Tell us a little bit about what's going on in his personal life while this is going on and then afterwards.
Right. When he was trying to become a spy in Madrid, his wife was sort of his partner in crime. Araceli was her name. She was beautiful. People compared her to Ava Gardner. And they were really partners. They created these characters together. They created the spy network. But once they got to London, Araceli hated London. It was blacked out. There was very little food available. She couldn't tell anyone that her husband was a war hero. And she was lonely for Spain. She was lonely for her family. So they began to fight, and the marriage began to sort of falter. And there was one extraordinary moment where she became so sick of all the sort of loneliness and everything. She had two children at the time that she had to take care of by herself, that she threatened to expose Pujol to the Germans. And so Pujol had to sort of turn all his intelligence skills and run an operation on her. Basically, he said that he confronted the head of MI5 and threatened him, and they got into a sort of a tussle over the idea of Araceli's honor, whether she was going to really report him or not. And he was facing execution because the British were so worried that this couple were going to sort of blow their cover. It was all fake. It all came out of Pujol's mind. But he was in a prison, and Araceli, his wife, was brought to him in a blindfold. And he basically said, tomorrow they're going to judge my case, and, you know, I might be shot. And this was all to sort of convince her and really to terrify her into stop this threat of exposing him. It's a really sort of, to me, it was sort of a heartbreaking moment, because they started this thing together. And now he sort of realized he was the superior spy, the superior deceptive person, and he had to use it on his wife. And it was sort of really the end of the marriage. She never really found out that he'd done it. But I think it was sort of the end of that sort of bond of trust that they had. And so after the war, he wanted to get away. They moved to Venezuela, but the marriage broke up soon after, and she moved back to Spain with the three children. I actually went to Spain to research the book. I lived there for almost a year, and I met the children. They're all living in Spain, and the grandchildren. And they didn't find out till nearly 30 years later that their father was still alive. So he paid this enormous price, having his children believe that he was dead, all really because of his war effort and the mission that he was on.
You're listening to Stephen Talty. He's the author of Agent Garbo, the brilliant, eccentric secret agent who tricked Hitler and saved D-Day. So he went to South America. Tell us about that chapter of his life. And did he have another family there? I think he did, didn't he?
He did. Yeah, he went to South America. He had, believe it or not, when he was in London, the Germans believed he was supporting a network of 26 spies. So they would send him really large amounts of cash. Some of it went to fund the whole deception effort. He really sort of paid for, you know, many operations that happened on the Allied side. But when the war ended, they gave him the remaining amount of money. He went with Erichelli and his two children to Venezuela, to Caracas. And again, he sort of reverted to that sort of pre-war figure that he was, sort of a dreamer who just couldn't make his dreams work. So he tried a bunch of businesses, a farm, and it got repossessed by a Venezuelan dictator. And he was broke again, and Erichelli left him with the children, so he was alone, living in Caracas, you know, completely unknown, cut off from his family. And he began again. He married a local girl, had children with them. They still live in Venezuela. I was in contact with them during the research for the book. And he actually came to have a very humble and happy life, but he never sort of bragged about his war effort. And occasionally, because South America was sort of crawling with ex-Nazis and neo-Nazis, he would get worried that, you know, German agents were on his trail. And his son told me a great story about two guys from the British embassy contacting him. And he actually thought that they might be undercover Nazi agents coming to assassinate him. So he really lived in fear of this for the rest of his life. And he was finally rediscovered in 1984 and brought back to England for the D-Day celebrations. So he finally got to meet, you know, right on Omaha Beach, some of the men whose lives he really saved. I think that was really the great reward for him. You know, he got to see these men with their children and their grandchildren, and he realized that, you know, if it had not been for him, the resistance at Normandy would have been much stronger. The days after Normandy would have been a completely more brutal battle, and a lot of these guys would not have survived. So I think for him, after 40 years, that was the reward.
Was he dealt with at that 40th anniversary as a spectacular hero of the cause, or was he just another one of the guys who shows up?
No, the British papers went crazy, and they, you know, they really put him alongside Montgomery and Eisenhower as the heroes of the war. He was sort of the last untold hero of World War II, which was good and bad for him because he still hadn't reconnected with his family in Spain, and he knew that this word was going to get out. And I actually spoke to his oldest son, Juan Pujols Jr., if you like, and he was in the bathroom. He was in, I think he's probably in his late 30s, and he heard this announcement of a new Spanish war hero that had been discovered, and they said the man's name. He's like, my God, it's my father. So this man had grown up his entire life believing his father was dead, and here he was appearing in London, you know, christened as a new war hero, but they'd missed all those decades of life together, and it was sort of joyful in one way for him, but very intensely, you know, emotional and heartbreaking for him and his brother and sister as well.
So was the family able to make peace with their father?
Yeah, to Erichelli's credit, she actually met with the three children and she said, listen, you know, you can play this two ways, basically. You can either be bitter and questioning him and ask him why, but by this time, Pujol was an old man. He was probably in his late 60s, early 70s. And she said, you probably only have a few years left. You know, let them be loving years. And so they sort of let it all go into the bridge. They never questioned him why he'd never sort of reappeared in their lives. They each had their theories. They sort of let it go, and they spent the time they had with him and sort of, you know, became a sort of mini family again. So he wrote them letters. He told them all about his life. He never really truly explained himself. I mean, the two things he said were, you know, I was afraid that people were going to track you down and hurt you. And the other thing was, he was a very traditional Spanish man, and he didn't have the money to sort of come back and, you know, pay for their education and sort of help them out in the way that he probably would have liked to. So I think perhaps he was a little embarrassed, and he didn't want to sort of come back, you know, penniless to them and not be able to give them anything. So they were very sort of gracious about it, and they, when I spoke to them, they would break down and cry, but they were very grateful that he'd come back into their lives.
This whole issue of his inability to move back into life, now admittedly he was worried about being discovered, but don't you think there's probably a lot of ex-spies running around out there who have a pretty difficult time acclimating themselves to the real world after living in a situation like World War II?
Yeah, I think especially the double agents, because it's a really particular skill set that you have to be a double agent. And a regular spy can just sort of stay with the CIA or stay with MI5. But these guys were not professional. They were really amateurs dabbling in it just for the war. And they couldn't make a career out of it. You know, actually, MI5 thought of running Pujol against the Soviets because they knew that the Iron Curtain was descending over Europe and that he was so perfectly positioned, really, to sort of, you know, transfer his allegiance to the Soviets. But, of course, Kim Philby and the Cambridge Circle knew about Pujol, and they told their, you know, Soviet spy masters not to get involved with this guy, that he was a double agent. So that was sort of perhaps his one hope of having a permanent clandestine position. But, yeah, I think a lot of these guys sort of, especially the guys who were not in it for the money, I mean, he did it sort of out of his own moral reason. So, you know, if he had been perhaps a little more aggressive and a little less moral, perhaps he would have survived better in the post-war world. But, you know, he'd done it for sort of reasons of conscience, and that didn't really translate into the business world afterward.
What convinced you to write the book? By the way, we've never explained Agent Garbo. I mean, you've been talking about Juan Pujol, but Agent Garbo, you might explain how he managed to get, who gave him that name?
Right. Well, Germans had given him one name, and then when he came and he was debriefed by the Allies in London, they had to come up with a new code name for him. And somebody said, "This man is the best actor in the world that I've ever met." And the best actor in the world at that time was Greta Garbo. So they named him Garbo. And I think a part of that was also, if they named him Garbo, the Germans, if they ever came onto that name, would be looking for a woman. So it was sort of a double layer of protection for him. But yeah, that was his skill. He could just convince you of anything in the way that a great Hollywood actress or actor could. And so that became his name.
Had much been done on this guy before you discovered him? How did that happen?
No, actually, I was just reading, you know, I'm a fan of espionage books, and I was reading, and I found one sentence in a book on World War II about Agent Garbo, and they described what he'd done. And I said to myself, you know, there must be four or five great books on this guy. And I looked into the sort of archives, and I found that he'd written a book right after the war, and I got the book, and it was full of falsehoods. I mean, he was still a spy, and he never mentioned really Araceli. So there were huge parts of the story that were hidden. So I found there was no sort of definitive book on Garbo, and I was you know, astonished by that. So it just seemed a perfect opportunity to find a really ordinary man. I mean, someone who was really just like you or me before the war, who sort of stepped into this moment in history and became something that was really, you know, beyond anyone's imagination. And that was what appealed to me, was that he sort of created himself. He didn't go to any, you know, spy school or anything like that. This was all sort of an act of will, and that's really what appealed to me.
Well, you've done a great job. Our guest today is Stephen Talty. Thanks so much for joining us today, Stephen.
Thanks a lot. I enjoyed it.
The name of the book, Agent Garbo, the brilliant, eccentric, secret agent who tricked Hitler and saved D-Day. I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Stephen Talty. Next week, Pamela Rottner Sakamoto, author of Midnight in Broad Daylight, A Japanese-American Family Caught Between Two Worlds. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. We invite you to follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook. Find us by searching for Reader's Corner.